You're listening to the Wheeler Center podcast. Last week, we heard from satirist Armando Iannucci in two conversations, first with comedian Tony Martin, then with political journalist Annabelle Crabb. Rather than choosing just one, we've decided to share each of these discussions in full, so you can take your pick or binge on both. Bear in mind that this is Armando Iannucci we're talking about, so strong language is to be expected. Here he is in conversation with Tony Martin.
Hello? Is this working? She's got things to do. Don't worry, I'm not going to waffle on for too long. We've got a lot of business to get through. Before we get started, I do need to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land that we're standing on, the Grollo family. The Kulin Nation, of course. Full respect to the elders, past and present. Although I have to say, there was no such announcement at the last show I saw in this theatre, which was a play by John Michael Hollywoodhausen called More Sex, Please, We're Seniors. Don't know if anyone saw that one. But by way of contrast, tonight we have one of my comedy heroes is here, and it's incredibly gratifying to see so many people here to see a man whose work was, for the first 10 or 15 years of his career, completely unobtainable in Australia. I'm sure there's a few nerds like myself who remember in the early 90s sending away for VHS copies of The Day Today via a little shop called Mr. Benson's, who used to advertise in the back of Empire magazine. Anyone? There must be a few of you. And, obviously a lot of people are here because they've seen Veep and the thick of it. And I have to say, we all have, don't we? We all have our top shelf of great comedy films and TV shows, things that we give 5 stars to. Spinal Tap, it might be Fawlty Towers or Withnell and I, or if you're my mum, The Good Life, or just anything that Penelope Keith was in. But our guest tonight, for mine, is someone who has at least 4 shows on that list. And let's get him out right now. It's Armando Iannucci. There he is.
Thank you so much. Hello.
Thank you, Armando.
Hello. Hi. Hi. talking of your mum.
Yes.
I just reminded you were saying how amazing it is. I am constantly surprised when I see people have come out to see me, because I'm convinced that outside of the UK, no one knows who I am. And I think there's an element of Catholic guilt about that. And I was once invited to do something similar to this at the Scottish Parliament, which over the summer, when it's in recess, they do this thing, a festival of politics, and they have these, and they invited me up. And my mum, who's 90 and lives in Glasgow, was driven through as a special guest of the Scottish Parliament to come and see me. And my wife was there next to her, and I hadn't come on yet. And my wife just tells me, my mum just looked around and just went, "This is a very big room. Do you think they'll fill it?" Oh. And the guy from the Scottish Parliament said, "Mrs. Iannucci, we could have sold this out 3 times over." And without missing a beat, she said, "People are paying."
So, well, my mum is in New Zealand. I understand you've just been over there.
My very first trip to New Zealand, yes.
Right. Known there? Are the people?
Well, yes. No, they came out. They came out. And I've been to Australia several times. We've got friends in Adelaide. The last time I was in Adelaide, I was ill. And I had this thing called Bell's palsy, which is a sort of viral thing. Basically, half your face just freezes up. And you end up speaking like... I'm not being offensive. I'm just doing me. So, but I ended up speaking like that. And they thought, they take you into hospital because it could be a stroke. So you're kept in overnight to see if it's just something simple or if it's a stroke. It went away after 2 weeks. So I went into the hospital in Adelaide. And they they asked me some questions just to make sure I wasn't, there wasn't something else going on in there. So asked for my name. I went, "Oh, Andrew Nucci." And then and he said, "Do you know where you are?" And the thing was, I didn't, because I don't live in Adelaide, and I was in a hospital, and I didn't know which hospital. So I said, "No, but I can tell you who your prime minister is." And Kevin Rudd was the prime minister. I went, "It's Kevin Rudd." And I didn't realise that the day before, Kevin Rudd had actually been stabbed. So, and I could see her write down confused on the thing.
Well, now you've been...
I didn't really expect I would start off talking about nervous diseases. But anyway, yeah, carry on, sorry.
No, you've been touring around, and yeah. I was having a look at how last night's event in Sydney went on Twitter, and I noticed there were signs up at the venue warning people that there may be foul language.
Yes, coarse language, I think they said. Coarse language. And I don't swear. I'm not a swearer.
No, but I noticed a lot of people on Twitter were saying he was a lot less sweary than I was expecting.
Yeah,
And you've been promoted in, I think, clinging on to ideas that people will connect with you. They seem to almost suggest that you are Malcolm Tucker
and
you're always swearing.
I think they're confusing fact with fiction, you see. And you know, writers write, and we happen to write sweary things for Malcolm Tucker to say, because when I was researching The Thick of It, I looked at politics and I spoke to people who worked in that business. Yep. And they said there is a lot of swearing that goes on, and it's a fast, frenetic environment. It's a sort of environment where everyone thinks that they are doing the most important job in the world, and it has to be done fucking now, even if it is just putting out a press release about how we might get the Commonwealth Games here in four, you know, but it's still fucking got to be done now. So there's a lot of this going on, you know? Even in the emails, if you read the emails, it's like it's tight like this, you know. So we had to put swear. I felt for it to be realistic, it has to be swearing. And then comes the thing, though: how do you make it interesting? It can't just be the same word again and again and again, because that just becomes deeply dull. So it's then about being inventive with the language.
Always read that you had a writer who. Whose dedicated job was thinking of new swear words. Is that a
swearing consultant?
Is that true?
No, it's one guy who was particularly good at making Malcolm swearing. He wrote this website. There was a really funny website, and I got in touch with him and said, "This makes me laugh. Do you want to do a bit of writing for the show? We'll send you the scripts, and you just add whatever you like." And the script usually arrived back. His editions were in red, so it was very easy to kind of read. And he won us over with the first one, because the opening episode, the very first episode of The Thick of It, opens with Malcolm on the phone going, just talking about a minister. And in the script, it just says, "No, he's useless. He's completely useless." To which Ian, our swearing consultant, added, "He's as useless as a marzipan dildo." And he's also become a dildo expert as well, actually, because in Veep, I think Selena Meyer says that is about as useful as a croissant dildo. It doesn't do the job, and it makes a fucking mess. You know?
I remember there was one episode where Malcolm described someone as having a face like Dot Cotton licking piss off a nettle.
Yes.
Dot Cotton from EastEnders, of course.
Yes. You see, there's no swearing in that. Absolutely no swearing. So it is possible to do it, you know. I do like the idea of there being a swearing correspondent on the news. That would be...
Yes, right.
You join us, the strike now is into its fifth fucking week. And there's no way these cocksuckers are ever going to agree. It's really cunted. Back to the studio. You know, just... What was that? Just kind of... I just think surely with online and digital and, you know, we could get a kind of ABC swearing or something.
Didn't you have, weren't you awarded Word of the Year one year?
Mm.
For what was the word?
Yeah, it was Omni Shambles. And it became, Malcolm calls the minister a complete Omni Shambles. From bean to cup, you fuck up. And then our Chancellor, our late Chancellor George Osborne, who's now no longer an MP but is the editor of a daily newspaper in the UK, presented this budget, and it all kind of fell apart within the week. All the tax bans that he was proposing fell apart. The sums just didn't add up, and he had to withdraw some of it and change some of it and do a U-turn. And the leader of the opposition at the time, Ed Miliband, called it an omni-shambles budget.
Right.
And everyone thought that was, you know, how brilliant of Ed Miliband, until it was pointed out that he nicked it from the thick of it.
The thick of it.
You know, and these things happen. These things... And so the Oxford English Dictionary made it its word of the year because it started becoming. But these things do happen because in Veep, when Selina Meyer runs for president, she has to sit down with her team and come up with a campaign slogan that is the most inane, pointless, doesn't say anything, doesn't trouble anyone. And she came up with continuity with change.
Yes. And I think we stole that one, didn't we?
Well, so Turnbull said continuity and change.
Oh, right. He's changed it.
Yeah. And we said, you've stolen our campaign. And then they came back and said, no, you're continuity with change. We're continuity and change. So clearly a lot of very expensive image consultants were brought in. Because continuity and change is, you're getting two things there.
Yes.
You're getting double. Continuity with change, it's a linear, one-level thing. Continuity and change, there's a progression, there's a multiplicity about it. It signifies, it's aspirational, it signifies, you know, it's radically different, I think.
Well, I actually...
You know, and it worked. It worked, so, you know.
When that was pointed out, that he was stealing your material, he went over to... He had Jobs and Growth for a while.
Yeah.
And then less successful was Opportunity and Security. Do you remember that one?
Absolutely.
It's just any two words, really, isn't it?
Any two words. Pancakes and fuck is...
you know. Colour and movement. We've got it all.
Dance and Pisces.
Now, you mentioned Malcolm Tucker. Let's dive straight in. I heard an interview recently where you described Malcolm Tucker, or the way you saw him was simply as a bastard.
Yes.
Now, he was a bastard, there's no denying.
Yeah.
But I have to say, I watched all of the thick of it again recently, and it's amazing what your mind does when he gets sacked. It's quite terrible. I felt incredibly sorry. Remember, you do it twice because you have him, he kind of gets sacked and then he comes back and then there's the ending where he's really gone.
Yeah. Well, it's like, I mean, all people love villains, don't they? They want, you know, you want Darth Vader to turn up. You want, you know, I did a whole thesis at University on Paradise Lost and why are you laughing?
So I was just trying to picture having sympathy for Darth Vader if he finally went down.
No, but Satan is the villain in Paradise Lost, and he's great. He does these fantastic speeches and so on. I stopped doing the thesis when it struck me that the opening lines of Paradise Lost, of man's first disobedience and the fruit of that forbidden tree, have the same rhythm to the theme tune to the Flintstones, which is of man's first disobedience and the fruit of that forbidden tree. And that's where I thought, I'm not taking this seriously. But the point I'm making, the point, yes. I was on Q&A this week, so I was practicing. The point I'm making...
We'd just like to all of us apologise for Barnaby Joyce. So just get that out. Sorry about that. Sorry you had to sit through that.
I spent 3 days prior to it, and people asking me, what are you doing? I'm like, well, I'm going Q&A. Oh, who's on it? A Barnaby... I said it, not knowing. A Barnaby Joyce? And people go, oh, yeah. yeah, he's interesting. Yeah. he threatened to shoot
Johnny Depp's dog. That's what we do here.
Yeah. Yeah, so he's got time on his hands.
Yes.
I was in between him and Tanya So I was in between them, and I found myself actually on live television because they were having a real go at each other. I realised I was on live television doing this. And once that enters your consciousness, you don't know whether will it actually show if I stop. So... Actually, should I just carry on for the next 50 minutes and no one will notice? I mean, the camera team will just go, well, don't point the camera at him. He's clearly crazy. Probably got Bell's palsy again coming on. Or you know, it's just so, yeah, it was so interesting. But you do find when you mix with politicians, the other thing they do is, because this is rude, you see, that they used to do that a lot.
Right.
You know, which is a, you know, I mean, they used to do that, and then they do that. But it's
that's
still
coming back.
That is coming back. It's a sort of. So that's rude. You can't have politicians. People don't like politicians who point. So you get this a lot, which is politicians with this, which is a gesture no one else in the world ever uses. You don't go into the bakery and go, I'd like a croissant, I'd like two loaves. But politicians use this because it sort of looks firm. It looks kind of like a punch, but it's not a punch. And there's an element of thumbs up. And it's a gesture come up by a committee just for politicians to use. Apart from Trump. Trump doesn't use it. He does this a lot. And given he's got this, you know, macho, I tell you, I'm going to, you know, all these sentences flying about it. Similar. He does five, you know, those Peruvian flute people who can play four notes at once. He can speak five sentences simultaneously. He does a kind of, we're building a wall. We're going to, and by the way, Congress, if you vote for Congress, then I tell you, a beautiful piece of chocolate cake, beautiful piece. I tell you, get him out of here. Get him out of here. Beautiful. They're like, it's bizarre. But he does this gesture. And I'm thinking, how do you satirize that? And there's a guy in the UK called Peter Serovinovich.
Yes, yes.
Who does this thing called Sassy Trump. If you look it up on YouTube, Sassy Trump. It's Donald Trump's words, unaltered, not changed or edited in any way, but just revoiced. So instead of beautiful, it's beautiful wall. It's gonna be so splendid. You're gonna so love it. I say chocolate cake. You know, he does it, and it completely takes the kind of macho air out of it. But the other thing it does is it actually makes you listen to what he's saying.
Yeah, he does another version where he does him as a Cockney hard man.
Oh, yeah, I must listen to that one. Yeah.
That seems to work just as well. Are you sick of being asked about Donald Trump? It seems like everywhere you go, he's like your nemesis.
Well, no, only in that. You know, people say, how is it a problem? How do comedians now tackle Trump? And you know, what I've been saying is, especially satire at its most basic, not I want to generalize, but I will. Satire is like you take something that is true and then you manipulate it, and you distort it, and you bend it out of shape so it becomes something really ridiculous. But that's what Trump does anyway. That's every sentence does that. Every sentence, he's like I call him a self-basting satirist, really, because he is a comment on himself. And, you know, so every sentence he starts, the first three words are fine. They're fine. You know, no problem. So it's, you know, the first three words, it's the plane just taxiing gently. And then it takes off. And then it just suddenly does a dive and a loop the loop and a kind of, you know, just flare coming out from behind it. And then while he's doing that sentence, another plane takes off and they kind of occasionally are in formation. And then by the end of the sentence, they just head for each other, really, and crash. And so that is the problem.
It's not just that it's absurd, it's that there's so much of it. I mean, it's like comedians' entrees are so... I mean, this week we've had him, he's completely misinterpreted the Civil War, the causes of that.
He says that there's Andrew Jackson, he said, was upset by the Civil War, not realising that Andrew Jackson died about 20 or 30 years prior to the Civil War.
Yeah, that's right. He got the timeline slightly wrong. And then he was also saying that, you know, it would be so easy to get all of his ideas through if it wasn't for this annoying thing called the Constitution.
Getting it his
way. And then he's sort of just walking around boasting about how various people have told him that he's the greatest, his first 100 years are the greatest, his
first 100 years.
Wow. It seems like 100 years. His first 100 days.
His 1,000 years are going to be a Reich that will be.
But it's only Wednesday. I know. We've already, there's too much, you know,
I think
years
he's
ago,
done more than any other president to say how well his first 100 days have gone.
That's
I
right.
think we can grant him that. But there is that thing. He is a salesman. That's what he does. Hmm. And, you know, and he's been a success successful salesman. He has a knack for selling the idea. And you know, of course, if someone's going to say, I'm going to make your life so beautiful, they're all idiots, it's going to be good, trust me, you kind of want to believe it. And that's what happens. His problem is he doesn't know what to do after the selling of it.
No.
You know, he doesn't, you know, he's not, you know, he's the second-hand car dealer who's sold you the car, but then just can't go home. He's then got to kind of sit in the car with you for the next 4 years. And that's the problem, because you're driving the car and you're thinking, this is a bit stiff, and don't worry, you know, it'll be fine, you know. Just don't look ahead, don't look, you know. And what I worry about him is that, yes, he can change history with Andrew Jackson and civil wars and 100 days becoming 100 years. He can change all that, but I do worry that we've got so used to it that we no longer point out that this is madness.
No.
It's absolute madness. And this is the first week. When he went off and all that, in like one day, he was trying to change the Constitution, trying to change history, trying to change time and space and the laws of physics and everything. There was one congressman who was quoted, who, for the first time, I heard a congressman actually say, I think there's something rather worryingly about his mental condition, actually. I think,
yeah.
You know, it's the first time someone's actually said, we ought to look at this. There is
there was
someone who is quite ill, is in charge of this country.
Well, yeah. There was a quote this week that someone heard George W. Bush leaving the inauguration going, how bizarre was that? Like, even he's believe what he's hearing.
Yeah, it's a sad reflection that we now look back at George W. Bush with some affection, really.
That's right.
This kind of very bright, intelligent, focused, and a very competent team around
That's
him.
That's right. The steady hand on the tiller of George W. Bush.
Just, we look up with some affection.
But what about, I mean, I was thinking about Watergate. If Watergate, that would be just nothing. I mean, if that happened to...
That's day one. But it took Nixon... It took Nixon 6.5 years to get to being indicted, Congress being suspicious about him, having to sack various people in his administration. They're all leaving now. This is like 100 days. The Nixon. We should call it, maybe the 100 days, the unit of 100 days should be called the Trump.
Yes.
You know.
Well, I was thinking about this in regards to your work, because I remember on Veep, when Selena Meyer eventually became president, I remember looking at the show and looking at all of those characters and just thinking how terrifying that would be if those people actually were
right.
in charge.
Yes.
If those were the decision makers.
And now
and then you're going, well, it doesn't look, by comparison.
It is strange. When I was every season, before we write a new season, we go out to Washington, we do research and so on. And after about season two, people in Washington in various departments would come up and introduce themselves as the character from the show. So they go, hi, I'm the Dan of Senator Graham's office. Pleased to meet you.
Right.
Over there is the Amy of... no one introduces themselves as Jonah. but they all say they know a Jonah. You know, that guy over there is a Jonah. I'm the Dan. Hi, I'm the Gary of... And it's the same with Alan Partridge. Whenever you do any radio interviews,
yes.
they always say, there's a guy just like Alan Partridge over there. Not me. You know, there's a real kind of... So there's an element of that. And the other thing I noticed about in Washington is how much they love the idea of having a TV show about them, even though what's on that TV show reflects badly. They still love that idea. It's almost like the television version is more important than them. When we were first shown around, we were shown around the White House in the West Wing by a guy called Reggie Love, who was Obama's Gary, basically, but much cooler. He was like a tall ex-college basketball superstar, and he was called Reggie Love. And in the White House, everyone wanders around with a surname on a kind of ID thing. So he wanders around with Love, you know, and he's high-fiving everyone. But he showed us a room. He said, this is the Roosevelt room. This would be where CJ and Josh would talk about.
Oh,
and I'm thinking,
God.
Why are you referencing the TV show, The West Wing? This is it. Why don't you say, this would be where I sit down with Barack Obama and discuss the day? That's far more interesting than some fictional thing from 15 years ago. And it is this strange... And it's similarly... It's partly why I decided to stop doing the thing of it, and indeed,
It's when the politicians start adapting and adopting phrases from your show, because they somehow, there's a lot of people in politics who go into politics now modelling themselves on Malcolm Tucker as if he's their hero, and I just think, no, he's what's wrong. Yeah. You know, but they don't see it that way.
But it's that thing, he somehow ends up being a sympathetic character. I think one of the most pathetic sights I've ever seen on television was when you finally saw Malcolm Tucker at home and he was hosting a dinner party and he just had a jumper on.
Yeah.
Around.
You must get that. You must get this, what, the Sunday morning politics shows where politicians turn up in their jumpers and cardigans and funny hats and things like that. We get that. But somehow they've come into the studio, so they could have put a jacket on, but somehow they want to look like Sunday, you know.
Well, speaking of Alan Partridge, we're now...
they've been up all night, you know, to try and project an image of someone who's been up all Saturday night and is just drunk, kind of like, and shirt undone and sick down, kind of like, you know, I'm down with the kids, kind of like...
I'm starting to feel like Alan Partridge now. Let's get in a time machine.
Yes.
And
where should we go to? Because Henry VIII. Let's the Tudor.
Because I have to say, the first time I ever had an awareness of who you were was back in about 1991. Someone sent me VHS cassette from the UK of a segment from the Day Today, and it was Alan Partridge narrating a package of goals from football.
All right, goal!
That's right. And it was like he had
another.
But he had eight goals. A foot-like attraction engine.
Yes, yes.
But there was eight goals,
yes,
but he only had enough comments for five of them.
That's right, yes.
So by the end it was just, shit! Yes. And that was that was like the funniest thing I'd seen. So I remember sending away for the Day Today.
We recorded some that never used, because we did one where it was a marathon, but he recorded his commentary at the pace of a 100 metres dash. So, and they're off, and it's 59, and the first thing. But for it to work, you'd have to play 3 hours of that commentary. So you couldn't fit it in. And we did do one where it was the 100 metres, which you recorded at the pace of a marathon.
Right.
It went bang, just to go through the lanes again. In lane one, we have Shapova. Lane two, oh, it's over! It's over! But he started as a radio, radio commentary is great. I love radio sports commentary because they've got to keep talking.
Yes.
Because it's, you know, there's nothing else. So tennis is like, you know, it's a volley, it's a half-hand, it's a backhand, it's a backhand, yo! And you don't know what's happened, you know. I've never listened to golf, actually. What do they do for golf? It's up, it's
music,
going, it's still going up, it's curving round, the parabola is now turning down towards a tree. I don't, you know, but we used to, so I said to Steve, the Day Today originally was a radio show called On the Hour, so it was a spoof news show, and I said to Steve Coogan, can you do like a sports commentator, not an impression, but a voice that kind of sums them all up?
Right.
And, you know, obviously he does it much better than me. So he did this, hello, you joy, yes, all this kind of emphasis, for everyone, you know. And but the moment he started that, someone in the room said, he's called Alan.
Right, right, right.
And then instantly someone else went, and he's a Partridge. He's Alan. So he kind of, Alan Partridge formed. He was birthed, fully formed. It's like, you know, when horses give birth to a foal.
Right.
You know, and it sort of slithers out, and then it kind of just stands up and starts kind of galloping about. That's how Alan was. Alan was born kind of like,
right,
just in a kind of blazer covered in placenta. And with a massive microphone in his hand, which, you know, it's a painful delivery, but, you know, he was like, he was fully formed, and as soon as that started happening, we originally gave him just like scripts to read out, but actually he really came alive when we got Steve to kind of, when we went into looser things and got him to improvise these interviews. And the thing that really set him off was, he was interviewing one of the actors was playing Linford Christie, and he was in, we just said to Steve, make Alan just really obsessed with groin injury. Just keep going on about... Because I've always noticed that in athletics, they're always doing... You've got a bit of a groin strain there. Is it any... I mean, if we could just go back to the groin injury. Is it... How is it? Is it compacting in the undertuck? What's the... how is the... Is there a tent? You know, I know your lycra is tight. Is it, you know... And that seemed, somehow the press picked up on that, and that seemed to be the launch pad of Alan
Partridge. He was always at his best when he had to make something out of nothing. I think you did one where it was the horse racing was rained out, so he was just commentating.
Just filling in.
It was just a couple of kids on some stairs, and he's going, that tomfoolery might develop into blind, ugly violence.
But the thing about him is, you know, he's a broadcaster, and therefore he can't stop talking. That's, you know, his... His motto is "Dead air is a crime," and especially if you're on the radio. So he has to keep going, and it means there's endless reams of this stuff. I mean, when we're writing it, Steve paces about as Alan,
right,
and we are chucking stuff in. But it does feel like you are working with Alan all day, every day, and you start just going, "Please stop." I know this is good, but please, for the love of Christ, stop. And I've got a 300-page document of Alan Partridge stuff that we've never used.
Right.
It's just gobbets. I've got a whole monologue on taps. It just... I don't know why they have these taps where there's cold air and there's air and you're going like that, and I don't understand it. I don't know why they do. And also, when you're in the shower, yes, it comes down. That's good for the top half, but there's nothing underneath, you know. They should have like those sprinklers that you get in outside town halls on the lawn where they sprinkle round and round. I don't, you know, that way. And I won't do the B-Day. The B-Day is not, it's a separate instrument. I just think, because there's a Bond movie where he's in a shower and they're all I'm writing it down, but please put a fucking sock. This is just driving me crazy. It just goes, it's endless.
I think one of the my favourite Alan Partridge moments is in one of his, I think in his Christmas special, when he shows a little documentary about how the people at Tandy's electronics store allow him to visit the shop after closing hours. And then you can just see pissed off staff members. He's not going to buy anything.
No.
And there's a bit where he's just standing there with a CD player just opening the lid. Just going, that's a quality action.
You've... You've studied this a lot, haven't you?
Well, what amazes me is he started out...
Move my chair away ever so slightly.
There's more of them out there. Yeah. Don't worry. But what amazes me about Alan Partridge is, yes, he did start as just this sporting commentary, but it's almost the most fully rounded and developed comedy character of all time.
He's grown with us. There is this parallel time. Whenever Steve and I meet, we always ask ourselves, what is Alan up to now? Because we're running this life story in the back of our head. I've always wanted to do something where he gets a job as a tour guide on the top of a double-decker, open double-decker bus in Norwich, going round. In fact, I think we wrote it. It was going to be in the film at one point, and then we changed the opening. He's going down, and then he realizes the bus is going near some people that he owes money to. So he gets the driver to drive the bus just to an old industrial estate, but he feels he has to keep commenting to the tourists and the merits of this industrial estate. But so we're always kind of in the back of our heads. And also, because he emerged fully formed at the very start of our careers, and because we've only really brought him out every 3 or 4 years, we don't feel we've kind of flogged him to death doing 10 seasons, 22 episodes, you know, and it just runs out of steam. So it gives us the chance every 4 or 5 years to just slightly reformat him. So either he's on the radio or else he's doing his chat show, or he's no longer on the telly, he's in a hotel, or he's in a caravan, or now he's doing his radio show. He's doing this North Norfolk Digital, and because it's digital... And on the internet, he claims that there is a potential audience of 6 billion, which you know he's quite happy about. Actually, I think he's in a very happy kind of state of mind at the moment.
I think something very smart that you did with the movie is, I remember when I was a kid, British sitcoms would always make terrible films. It would be, Are You Being Served, would go to Mallorca.
They always go on holiday. They go abroad. Yes.
That's right. But Alan Partridge, when I heard there was going to be an Alan Partridge film, I thought, oh, he's going to go to Hollywood. It's going to be something like that. But you kept him in this dreary local town doing his radio.
It made it
show.
Worse actually because it was a siege. So he was like stuck in his workplace. There was no holiday. Yeah, because being trapped with Alan Partridge is probably everyone's nightmare. Sally Phillips, who played Sophie, the receptionist.
Yeah.
Very early on in the rehearsals, she was writing lots of notes about her character. And I said, what are you writing? And she said, oh, it's nothing. I'm just trying to get into there. And she was saying, I think if I was trapped in a lift with Alan Partridge, I would just burst out laughing. I just think I can't keep the laughter in. And we thought, oh, let's use that. So every time she appears in every episode, she has to run away because she's going to collapse in laughter. And Alan is just a bit troubled that this person is laughing at her.
The great thing about when he went to live in a hotel, in a motel, in a travel tavern.
Travel tavern, yes. Yes. It was equidistant between Norwich and London so that he could do either. He could do his radio show but get to meetings for the BBC.
But it was great to suddenly see him in different circumstances. And I remember there was a horrible episode where you had him sleeping with the receptionist at his production company.
Oh, yes.
And I remember thinking, what is Alan Partridge having sex going to sound like? Yes. And it was quite brilliant what you did because you had the lights went out.
Yes.
It was a completely dark room. And then you just heard his voice say, let battle come out.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's...
Yes. Do you like that?
And I think...
Shall I do it any faster or maintain the same speed?
And there was one episode where you had him coming out of the bedroom and saying... Classic intercourse.
Classic intercourse, yes.
But I mean,
yes, we gave him a Ukrainian girlfriend, and I think he quite enjoyed it, yes.
But he is one of those characters that it is just funny to imagine him in any situation.
Yeah. He's like a kind of imaginary friend.
Yes.
Although friend is too strong a word, I'd say. But he's certainly there.
But going back to the day-to-day, I think what was amazing about that show was it was the first time there was a piss take of the news that actually...
Right, yes.
Like when I grew up, it was the two Ronnies reading out fake news stories. But it actually looked and sounded exactly like a real news program.
Yes, we used the people who did the graphics for us actually did the graphics for the real news. Right. And they basically brought us all the ideas that were just too mad to go in the real news. But they said actually... It was the mad ideas that the newsmakers came up with, and which they themselves said, no, that's too crazy, you mustn't do that. So they brought them to us. I remember once seeing John Simpson, a British sort of foreign correspondent, but he was the presenter of one of the shows at 9 o'clock news at one point. He was talking about the space shuttle, and suddenly they brought in this 3D space shuttle that kind of swooped around him, and then... landed, and I just thought that's the craziest thing I've ever seen. But now it's and that was inspired the part of the graphics in the show. But it's now, you know, I don't think news has moved on really. It's
no,
I like the news is with noises now. Fox News does that a lot, you know, for breaking news, it just
swooping sounds.
Fuck,
but what, what was great?
Oh my Christ, just flying by, just you know. An oil well's gone off. Shit! You know, just...
you did a whole episode where it
three-dimensional oil coming out of the desk, you know, just to emphasise the point, you know. I heard on the news today, I was listening to the British news today, and they do that thing, I don't know why they do it, they do a thing of where they repeat the same sentence three times. They say, let's see, what's happened today? I don't know, just say, I don't know, Donald Trump tweeted. They'll go... It's the 10 o'clock news. Donald Trump tweeted today. Over now to our American correspondent, Timothy White. Thank you. Donald Trump tweeted today. Speaking earlier, the police said this. Donald Trump tweeted today. And you just think, why... Can you edit that?
Are they just filling time?
Filling
time,
yeah.
I think on Australian news, they will describe a fire... show footage of it, and then they'll go to the on-the-spot reporter who will just repeat all of the same information.
Yeah, yes. I'm now in the flames.
That's right. Yes. But you didn't...
It's hot here. It's very hot. Yes. Lighter note, small cat was today found charred at the bottom, you know. The shadow of a cat was today.
That's right. Yes. You did a whole episode on war. I think that was the best thing you ever did on the day today was the war episode. And I think the war wasn't the war resolved because the soldiers from both sides were able to rescue a cat from a high shelf?
Yes, it was right. It was a war on the Australia-Hong Kong border, I remember.
That's right. Yeah. But you did on the day today... I was watching again recently. You remember it as a news parody show, but there was a lot of other stuff going on in that show. You had a soap opera set entirely in a bureau de change.
Yes. Yes, which is a long, when you think about it, is a long, thin kind of... I just get the idea of the cast all lined up in a row, having to do like a half-hour drama every week. And then we put it on the back of a truck.
That's right, so it went on the road. But it was just great. Any sentence was funnier with the word bureau de change in it.
I'm closing down the bureau for an hour. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. But the day...
This is like a director's commentary.
It is. But...
You have seen the show. Have you seen the show?
But I'm going to move on from it. Would
oh,
be
thank Christ,
it would be very easy to just recall great Alan Partridge moments till the sun came up.
Yeah.
But a show you did that I don't think it's ever been shown here, but is a show called The Armando Iannucci Shows.
Yes.
Which you did, which was as far really from political satire as you can imagine, and it was quite a personal, revealing show. I watched the first episode of it this week, and it's just you talking about your fears, your fear of people judging you, the fear of people.
But I think that's true
fake.
Of everyone. I think I went through life thinking, well, I've gotten away with it so far, but at some point I'm going to be found out.
Right.
And I actually think everyone thinks that. I think a lot of your work is about just thinking, well, that day was fine. And nobody
I'm just sitting here waiting for Andrew Denton to come out and take over.
Yeah. But then, as you get older and you meet more, you have more experiences, you then realise that the whole world works like that. It's like, I mean, that was the thing I found out doing The Thick of It and Veep and just examining, or In the Loop, which was my film about the Brits and Americans sort of going to war. I met a guy who worked in the CIA, and he said, it's really paperwork. And he said, I kept dreaming, every day I dream that someone's going to tap me on the shoulder and say, see that room over there? And it's going to be the room with all the big screens on it and the people on the kind of the headphones talking to spies. And he goes, see that room over there? Come into this room now. And he said, it never happened. And he said, I'm just on this desk. And we went round various things like the State Department. The U.S. State Department.
Right.
And we got into it. Somebody said, just show them your BBC pass and say you're here for the 12:30. So I did. But BBC pass is just my face with the word BBC next. I mean, a three-year-old monkey could have done that on some primitive app. And I said, I'm here for the 12:30. And I got in. And then I was in the State Department. And I thought, I'm researching this for the film, so I might as well take some photos. So I started taking photos of the State Department. Someone came up and said, excuse me? And I said, I'm here for the 12:30. He went, it's just over there. And I went in, and it was Condoleezza Rice's press briefing. Very dull. And then when the film came out, I told this story, and it got back to... It was then Hillary Clinton was... And when she heard about it, she implemented a full security review.
Right.
So as a result of that, Hillary Clinton is still alive. So
right.
Yeah, but you get that. And politicians, you think that politics is all about people deciding things over a long period of time using expert knowledge. No, it's just people very, very rapidly in a room coming up with a decision because a decision has to be made then and there. And once it's made, them just going, well, I think we got away with it, but I don't really know, and that's part of the problem.
And what was it like going to America to make a show, having made all of your shows in England?
Yeah.
Was there a different approach required for
I thought
HBO?
There would be, but we went with the Thick of It writers and the same style. I mean, a fantastic cast, a big American cast. And the experience of doing it was, I mean, it was a different set of politics there. You know, you couldn't have someone like Malcolm Tucker speak like that to the vice president, because if he did, he would just be immediately thrown on the floor and dragged out by five security men. Because, you know, in America, the office is regarded, not the person, but the office is treated with respect. It's because the president is the head of state. And the vice president is, you know, the deputy head of state. So you have to give them that edge, you see. And also, in the thick of it, it's a very junior minister with no power, whereas the vice president is, she's on a big public stage, and the decisions that they make do impact all around the world, as we're hilariously discovering over these last few weeks. You know, these things do have ramifications. But then also you discover that, although they say they're powerful, their power is, there's checks and balances in America with the Senate and the courts. So the American president isn't this all-powerful, you know, he can launch missiles.
Yes.
You know.
Yes.
You know. And it's a sad thing to do that Donald Trump will soon find out that the only thing he can do is launch missiles.
Doesn't he have... Is this true that he has a button now where someone will bring him a Coke?
Yes. Yes.
And
yes.
It's a red button.
I know.
That's quite...
Let's hope he gets... You
that's
know,
disturbing.
He was... When I was in New Zealand... Because when I was in New Zealand, he'd just done this press conference where he said how he launched missiles at Iraq. And then somebody said, Syria. Syria. And I was saying in New Zealand, you know, the next on the plan is North Korea, but it may be North Ireland. Who knows?
Just, no.
You know, depends how...
Look out, Otrahonga.
Yes.
But he's... now, you've stopped... You left Veep after the fourth series. Has it been strange watching one of your shows continue without you?
No, I kind of like it, really, because I've got nothing to do. I said... You know, I decided after 4 years of jet lag and... Really, some terrible experiences on United Airlines.
Scorpions dropping.
Scorpions dropping. My rabbit was shot. I hadn't filled in a form properly, so they kidnapped my sister. And she's still... They've still got her.
Well...
3 years they've got her now, and I've taken her up with the officials. We tried to do a raid. We tried to get SES, but they couldn't get in because they didn't have their passports. And, you know... It's unbelievable. I mean, they should look at their PR. They really should. They're shocking. But it really put me off. And I was sort of jet-lagged. And after four, you know, in the UK, we don't do that many shows. We just do six.
Yes.
1 year. There is a Simpsons episode where Homer is raising money to fund a seventh episode of his favourite British TV show. Which kind of... says an awful lot. But when I was out there doing Veep, you know, I'm enjoying it. But, you know, within 4 years, we'd done 40 shows, and it was nonstop all the year round, kind of writing them and then making them. So after 40 shows, I kind of felt I'd given it my all. And I was asked if I wanted to stay on with the new people taking over. But I just thought, no, I don't want to be like that. They've got to know that they're in charge. I don't want to be hanging alone like Pope Benedict, just kind of like... refusing to die, and well, he wants to get on with these reforms. So I kind of just thought, no, just leave me out. Just assume I'm dead.
And you've made a film in the interim.
I have made a film called The Death of Stalin.
Wow, it's a comedy.
It is a comedy. It's and the clue is in the title as to what it's about. When Stalin dies, really, and the power struggle that goes on in the Kremlin to take over. And Steve Buscemi plays Khrushchev, and Michael Palin is Molotov, and there's a great cast in it. But it's really based, again, on lots of true stories about... I just wanted to look at what happens when someone imposes terror on a country, absolute terror. And that's what Stalin did. On a nightly basis, people on his lists of enemies were rounded up and taken off to prison or the gulags or shot. And that went on for 20 years. And you can only have so many enemies. I think he got through those in the first five nights. And the rest of it, people were just shoving any old name they can think of. You know, a cousin that they didn't like or something. Yes. So it was horrible. But there were actually Stalin joke books circulating at the time. So people felt the need to laugh about it, even though if someone heard them make those jokes, they could be shot. But it's based on true... It opens on like a concert held in Moscow, town hall, Mozart piano concerto playing away, broadcast live on Radio Moscow. The controller of Radio Moscow gets a phone call in the middle of it. This is Stalin. I'm enjoying the concert. I'd love a recording. I'll send someone around to pick it up. Puts the phone down, turns to the engineer. Are we recording this? He goes, no. It's going out live. We're not recording it. And he just thinks, oh, God. I might be shot. And he runs out and he shouts at the audience, stop what you're doing. Nobody, shut the doors. Shut the door. Everyone thinks there's going to be some appalling. And shut the door. We're going to do it again. We're going to do it right now. Pianist, back up. Going to do it again. At which point the conductor, absolutely true, the conductor faints and knocks himself unconscious against the wall. So then they have to scour Moscow for another conductor. In real life, they got through two more conductors because the second conductor was really? Drunk. So they had to get a third conductor who's hauled out of his bed in the middle of the night thinking he's going to be shot. And he conducts it in his dressing gown and pyjamas. And that's all true. And so it goes on.
And you've got, did you say Michael Palin was in it?
Michael Palin is, he's great. Wow. Yes, it's lovely to see Michael Palin back on the screen,
very,
actually.
I saw that show, do you remember a show he did called GBH?
Yeah, great show.
Like he's a really good actor.
Thank God he's finished
travelling the world.
Yeah. No, he's
so you get back to acting.
He's fantastic. Now, I think we're going to be doing some questions.
Yes, I think we are going to hand the microphones over to people who might have more sensible questions. Do we have someone with a question?
No pressure, but we'll have to come down to the microphones. And there's some microphones up there as well, if anyone's
microphones
got a question.
Microphones for everybody.
Oh, the lights are coming up. Oh, my God, I can see you now. Someone's pointing a gun at me.
That man there has a question.
Right.
Yes, sir.
Yes.
How can we help?
Question number one, please.
I follow you on Twitter.
Okay.
And one of the sort of interesting things to be watching over the last few weeks or so is you've sort of launched this campaign in Britain about getting young Brits enrolled to vote.
Yeah.
The 18 to 24 sort of demographic. Yeah. I'm sort of curious what's been the response, because I know you retweeted one response that was quite cynical, and I'm sort of curious as to what's been the response to that overall.
The response so far has been positive. I mean, I have no idea what effect it's having. I mean, we have this, obviously you have compulsory voting here, we don't. And what has happened is that the youth vote has gone down over the last 20 years. The percentage of young people, 18 to 24 year olds voting in elections has gone right down. It used to be something like 65%, it's now down to about 40%. And as a result, politicians don't see young people or young voters as a threat because they just don't come out and vote. So therefore, when budget cuts have to be made, let's take it from education. Let's put tuition fees up. Let's take away housing benefit and student loans. And it's a circular thing. Then these voters then feel hard done by, so they therefore feel disconnected from politics, so they don't vote in the next election. And it becomes a cyclical spiral effect, really. So this is an attempt to sort of reboot. I think a lot of young people took up notice when we did the Brexit vote last year, because the young electorate were very much in favour of staying in Europe, but only 55% of them voted, whereas people over 65 were very anti-Europe, and about 90% of them voted. And if you had actually redressed that balance, it would have been a much closer result. So I don't know if anyone measures enthusiasm. I know everyone has to vote, but I don't know if there's a measure of how enthusiastically people vote here. Is there a kind of, do you have to say, I'm very excited, tick, or I couldn't be arsed, but I'm just going to draw a cock, you know. I don't know how it works. Do you get any figures saying how positively people regarded it? And
we have a very big drawn cock vote here in Australia.
Drawn cock. There will be the drawn cock party at some point, I'm sure.
Somebody upstairs have a question for our guest. Anybody? Just probably shout them out, actually. That's what people did when I saw More Sex, Please, We're Seniors.
I'll do general knowledge if you want, you know. Oh, hello. Or anyone else down here? Where are you?
It's hello. Me, God.
Hello.
What are the chances of a second season of the Amanda Iannucci show? Is that likely?
Second season of that? I want to do like a film version of that. Not necessarily with me in it, but I like the Amanda Usher shows had lots of interwoven stories. And I rather liked, they were both surreal and realistic at the same time. So I had things like a knife attack reunion where victims and criminals involved in a knife attack from 10 years ago were reunited and made speeches and had tea and...
I thought one of the funniest things I've ever seen was in that show, which was a regular character, an old man called Hugh.
Hugh, yeah. He would pop
around to your house and talk about life in the old days.
Yeah, the old days when the internet was in black and white then.
That's right. It was only on for 3 hours a day.
It was only on for 3 hours a day, yeah. Queen Victoria was the queen then, and I remember she went to the first premiere of Star Wars dressed as Jabba the Hutt. And, this kind of... Yeah.
No, that was...
So I kind of... That's the idea. I want to do a film where it's lots of different stories. Home for Middle-Aged Men. That was one that we did.
That's right.
Where just men in their middle age were just deposited by their wives in this home where they just sat there. And a nun came out and did a speech saying, not one of you in this room will be an astronaut. You sit in a sports car... But you look like a worm on a diamond. Okay?
I have to say, that show goes for about... The DVD is like £5 on Amazon. So I would. It's the best £5 you will ever spend. Who else do we have with a question? Down there, sir.
Armando.
Hi. Hello.
Back to the day-to-day and the on-the-hour... Yes. Era.
Yeah.
Could you talk about your work with Chris Morris, please, and maybe how you met him?
Oh, how I met Chris Morris. I heard him on the radio. Chris Morris was the presenter of the Day to Day and on the hour. I just arrived in London. I used to do lots of radio in Scotland, and I arrived in London, and I turned on the London radio station, GLR, and Chris was on it doing parodies of the news and parodies of sports reporters and disc jockeys and all that sort of thing. He had a DJ called Wayne Carr. Wanker! Was the jingle. And nobody seemed to notice. It was on Saturday morning.
Yes.
And nobody had picked up on this fact. He's great, Chris. He got someone to go to a tannoy in Heathrow Airport and just get them to read out the names to report to the information desk and recorded it. And he got one that said something like, could I have just farted... Please report to the information desk. I have just farted. Please come to the information. Anyway, I got in touch with him and said, look, are you interested? And we met at the BBC, and he's 1 year older than me. He, a similar background, he grew up listening to lots of radio comedy and did local radio. He, like me, went to a Jesuit school, and in fact, we shared some of the same teachers. You know, when various teachers were moved in disgrace, quietly on. It was usually to the other school. prelate ping pong, we called it. That's another thing. So we had shared this sort of same kind of disposition. And I remember he drove this huge, big, battered, old Mercedes car, just a tin on wheels. And I got into it, and we were outside Broadcasting House, and he was going to park, and we couldn't find anywhere to park. So we just went round and round the BBC for 2 hours, just discussing what to do. And that felt like the appropriate first meeting, really. Right. Two of us just in a car, circling. We'd probably be arrested if that was... It looked like a security risk, but at the time... You know, so we just basically just did a donut of the BBC for 2 hours, discussing what became On the Hour and then the day-to-day.
There's a story you always hear about Chris Morris that apparently a newsreader on a radio show was reading out an obituary for some member of the royal family, and Chris Morris had arranged to pump helium into the news.
Yeah, to this day, I don't know if it's true or not. It's one of the... It's an alternative fact. That's what it is.
Right.
It's fake news. Fake news.
Any more interrogators upstairs? Anyone?
There's someone down here. Oh, there's someone over there, yeah.
Over there, sir.
Oh, sorry, wait, was there somewhere? Okay, we'll come to you next. We'll do this and then... Do this? I'm so sorry. You're not this. Yeah. We'll do this and then that. And a bit of the other, okay? Right, yes.
The Amanda Iannucci show, I've heard, was originally aired in the weeks after 9/11.
Yes.
How did you feel about trying to promo and have your comedy show watched in those weeks? And
it was
feel
a disaster.
About...
It was like, which is why no one saw it. Even I wasn't watching it because the news was more interesting. So I spent about 18 months making this show very intricately short and lots of stories. And I mean, it was a big, big number. And then it went out the week of 9/11. And in the first program, there was an item, there was a sketch about an attack on the Pentagon. So what are the chances? But then Chris Morris and I, 6 months later, did a 9/11 parody in one of the newspapers. So we got our kind of frustration. It was time. I was like, 6 months is fine, isn't it?
It's fine.
It was acceptable. It was like how the viewing figures for the second Tower going down were lower than the first. Because people felt they'd seen it all before.
People were jaded.
But it's, you know, it was fine. So that's how I pettily got that out of my system. But it's sort of, you know, because everything's now available and on the internet and you can download, it's sort of taken on a new lease of life, which I'm very pleased about. Thank you very much. Thank you this. And now that.
Thank you very much, Tony and Amando, for coming to Melbourne tonight and entertaining us. But more so, the Auslan interpreter. Great to see. Thank you so much for...
Yeah, come on.
For doing such a brilliant job interpreting, without breaking into a sweat, signing the words croissant and marzipan dildo. Thank you.
I was told there are episodes of The Thick of It where we come up with whole new words. There is a signed version of The Thick of It. They had to come up with new signs, especially for The Thick of It, because, I mean, Cuntmeister? How's that? How does that...
That'll have to be pixelated for the Wheeler Centre.
Fuckety bye. How about fuckety bye? Yeah.
Very impressive.
Was that? It was just an observation. It wasn't a question. Yeah. Okay. I mean, it's a clear breach of the rules there. You know, if I was United Airlines, you'd be off that gallery straight to the crowd below. Absolutely no question. Yes. Okay, the other. Yes.
With the improvised Thick of It, and I'm guessing Veep, how much direction or script do they start with?
Oh, it's not improvised. I mean, 95% of it is scripted, and we spent all year scripting it. You know, a lot of work goes into the storylines and then the script, and we're always trying to come up with like the worst possible story imaginable that we invent, and then it goes out, and then a politician rings up and says, "How did you find that out? We kept that quiet. Is somebody telling?" We just say, "Oh my God, it's true." So, but what we do on set, we ask the cast to do the lines, but just to rough it up a little bit and play about with it. And also, we rehearse a lot with the cast, and they're all brilliant at, you know, bringing their own kind of thoughts and ideas. And you know, the on Veep, the chemistry between Selena and Gary is basically Tony Hale and Julia having, you know, they work on it, and they've got 101. She'll just suddenly in a take go, "Okay, I'm going to drop my bag, but I'm not going to tell you when I'm going to drop my bag." Right. So that he's kind of like ready to kind of catch it, you know, and things like that. Or sometimes I'll pull aside a cast member and say, you know, once we've done the scene, we're going to keep going. Could you ask him, as the minister, could you say to him, "I hear you do an impression of me, Ollie. Care to do it now, just to see what happens?" You know, because I like to put the cast on their toes. If you think about it, politics is very much making things up as you go along, because there's a camera in front of you. So I like to get that slightly scared, dead panic in the actors' faces, even though we've rehearsed it and even though they've learnt it.
There you go. I think we have time for one more question.
Okay,
that
this
there,
better be magnificent.
This will be a killer.
Right, everyone turn and look at him now. This question, yes.
A lot of your political satire is really about the absurdity of the system overall, but a lot of the comedians that do sort of comedy based on, say, the issues, they often get labelled as partisan. And so how do they navigate that when it seems that one side really has a monopoly on the crazy and the corrupt. What do they do?
Now, that's a partisan opinion, though, that one side has a monopoly on the crazy. Because at the moment, I don't know if it's here, but in the UK, both sides have gone pretty crazy recently. The left has gone very cultish. There's the cult of Jeremy Corbyn, where if you disagree with him, you're not to be listened to. And that used to be, the right used to have a monopoly of that. And my concern, I'm much more interested in engaging people in politics, even though I've spent the last 20 years putting them off it. Because I want people to be more interested in the issues rather than me. You know, if I want people to vote a certain way, I'll just say it. I don't want to do a comedy about it. I think you're on a hiding to nothing if you think the comedy will change anything. Peter Cook had this great phrase about how he loved the comedy of Weimar Germany in the 1930s, which did so much to halt the rise of Hitler. you can't change people's opinions from comedy. All you can do is maybe highlight things, illustrate it a different way, hold it up to the light, examine it from an unexpected angle. So I don't want to be partisan in that respect. What does worry me now is that people have retreated to their own, sort of social media groups of agreement. So you'll only follow people who agree with you, and you'll only tick on the news items that the ones you're interested in. So it does mean people aren't engaging with people who disagree with them. You know, if somebody says something, if you were to say something that if you disagreed with me, the tendency now would be to say, I'm offended that you have disagreed with me, actually. I find that in many ways, Yanuchiist about you, actually. So I don't want to, that non-platforming, and I think there's nothing wrong with being offended. There's nothing wrong. If you have views and beliefs, they should be able to stand up to people poking at them, really. They can't be very, very well, strongly held views if they crumble as soon as somebody just goes, that doesn't, you can't get through life being shattered every time someone goes, So anyway, does that answer your question? I don't know. Does it? Actually, I don't know.
Well, as a final treat
Fuck
for you.
Fuck Thatcher!
As a final surprise, Barnaby
She's
Joyce
here tonight.
Is here. everyone, could you thank our guest, Armando Iannucci?
Thank you very much. Thank you.
If you haven't seen any of the shows that we've been talking about, they're all available on the DVD format.
If you haven't seen them,
why are you here?
Who are you expecting?
I think you've got a book that might be available in the foyer. Were you aware of that?
I have no idea.
Somebody's written that
Somebody's
for him.
Book.
But
it's a John Le Carré novel. I mean, it's.
But
I bought it secondhand and I've left it in the foyer.
I think the cast of More Sex Please have got to fill this stage, so we've got to get out here. Thanks for coming along, and
thank you
to the Wheeler Centre.
Thank
Cheers.
You. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.